Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. It is Halloween 2013. What a scary day. And so I'm going to start out with a few scary stories. Hope you enjoy these. The main science topic I will be talking about, rogue waves. And for those of you not familiar with rogue waves, mainly known to people out at sea in smaller boats. Bigger ships, too, can experience these. But basically, a rogue wave, you're out in the middle of the ocean, you're in this, you know, the waves are a certain size and velocity and frequency, and they're coming regularly, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, comes a giant wave. It dwarfs all other waves that you've been experiencing. And these have been known to throw boats asunder, basically. And it's the fear of anybody at sea, because a sailboat or a person operating a sailboat could be thrown around and knocked unconscious or thrown overboard, and the ship basically capsized, etc. So, and these things happen, and it's called rogue waves. But the question is, where do they come from? This is a property of wave activity, something that in my new upcoming release, I'm talking about many things. I talked about symmetry. I talked about architecture and cathedrals. I talked about arches. I talked about the support of arches and the bases of arches, where they come down and firmly plant and hold up all that tremendous weight, and the weight of the arch is distributed down the columns, so to speak. Okay, so all of these have to do with, and then I spent a week last week talking about man's organization. I really didn't quite finish that topic. But basically, man has a knack or ability and a desire to organize, to put into organizational format, and it always strikes man odd when things just don't quite organize correctly. And so these tend to be things that vex the mind of man. They're in fact, for example, let's go into mathematics, something I happen to know quite a bit about. The idea that there are problems in mathematics that are not solved, they are not resolved, they are not, they don't lend themselves to the mathematical techniques, even though the mathematical techniques are very advanced and very complicated. There are problems that escape mathematicians and have for, in some cases, hundreds of years. I particularly am familiar with one. In fact, it was a problem that nobody ever imagined would be solved, commonly called the prime number problem, that is to organize and somehow put an organization to the prime numbers. And my book, Calculate Primes, did that. That's the public release of what I call the generator function, a function which directly calculates prime numbers. And everybody, in their kind of simple way of looking at things mathematically, thought that if there ever could be an equation that calculated prime numbers, it would start with the smaller prime numbers, and then you would calculate the bigger ones and then the next bigger ones in a linear fashion. And what I discovered is that the prime numbers are calculated in groups, and that once you get one group, you use that, you plug that back into the generator function to create the next group of prime numbers. And within about very few iterations of this process, let's say 10 iterations of this process, using the generator function that I developed, you have already identified 99.9% of all of the prime numbers from 0 to infinity. And now it's the work to identify those last percentage. So it's a process that's totally different than, for example, a sieve of Eratosthenes, where you take all the multiples of 2, then all the multiples of 3, and you do this by drawing lines through a table of numbers, and then all of the multiples of 5, and eventually you end up with prime numbers, but it doesn't give you any understanding about the prime numbers. It doesn't give you any ability to get a feel for what the prime numbers really are. One of the primary scholars, so to speak, of prime numbers, and I have this in my, I actually read this quote in the video that's included in my Calculate Primes book. One of the chief mathematicians that has worked on the prime number problem, and of course never was able to resolve it, said that the prime numbers, the best you could say about them is that they look like a random set of lottery numbers. That was the best thing they could say about the prime numbers. So when I developed the equation, the generator function, and the whole series of properties of symmetry, who in the world would ever have imagined that the prime numbers had symmetry or closure? Closure meaning that within a group of prime numbers, there is a closure property, that all of the elements within that group, it's a mathematical term, that all of the elements of that group are, if you add and subtract and multiply, all of the end results are within that group. It's a mathematical function or a property of group functions or of group theory. And the point is that the prime numbers follow wave patterns. And this is something also that a lot of people would recognize. For example, let me just give an example here. Let's go out to a relatively, what most people might consider a big number, although it's not, 30,030. That's 30030. 30,030. It turns out to be one of the magic numbers. It's a number that is equal to 2 times 5 times 7 times 11 times 13. And these are, I call them magic numbers because they're essentially the numbers around which the prime numbers are generated using the generator function, and symmetrically around these numbers. But let me point something out here. Let's start at the number 30,030, and let's look at the prime numbers to the right side, the positive side of 30,030. It's 30,047, 30,049, 30,071, 30,089, 30,091, 30,097, 30,103, etc. What you find is that the prime numbers, if you just add prime numbers, certain prime numbers, to 30,030, which is a magic number, you get other prime numbers. But that pattern fades away at a certain point. If you go to the left side of 30,030, let's go negative 1, so 30,029. It's a prime number. If you go minus 17, in other words, subtract a prime number 17 from 30,030, you get 30,013. And so I'm not going to belabor these numbers on the air because it's rather complicated. But the point is that there is a wave of prime numbers, and that wave peaks. It's like a rogue wave, so to speak, around the number 30,030, which is a magic number. They're also, in mathematical terms, I use the term magic number because they are magical. They're extremely magical, but in mathematical terms, that I call them sequential prime products. You take a sequence of prime numbers, beginning with the smallest prime number up to a certain prime number, you multiply them all together and you get a number that's very important because it has all of the prime factors in that number. And for that reason, they are magical in a sense. And it's something that the structure of the prime numbers around these magic numbers was never understood before. And that was one of the discoveries in resolving this 2,500-year-old math problem. But what happens is you have waves of prime numbers that come and then fade away, and then another wave of prime numbers begins, and a very different structure. And then you see these flowing. And that's why nobody could ever really get a handle on prime numbers, because they were just, it's a very complex problem. So now imagine that the prime numbers come in waves, and you superimpose one wave of prime numbers on another wave of prime numbers, and then superimpose another wave. This is very complicated mathematics. And for me to discover this was a major breakthrough in the field of mathematics. So at any rate, the point is that in real life, out in the ocean, you experience the same type of phenomenon as you find in the prime numbers, the rogue waves. Anyway. Okay, I'm going to stop talking about that for a minute. I'm going to come back to that subject as the main science topic, and we'll see how that also affects somewhat our daily lives. But since tonight is Halloween, I have three scary stories, kind of goblin and ghost stories, but I'm not very good at telling ghost stories. In fact, I was invited to be on Coast to Coast to tell ghost stories, and I'm not the person to tell ghost stories. I'm not very good at it. I don't have many good ghost stories, and so I'll leave that up to the other people that are taking part in that show tonight. But I appreciate the offer from Tom, the producer, and George, the host there. But I would not be a good candidate to give scary stories, like Halloween-type scary stories. But I have some other scary stories that relate more to probably everybody out there. For example, your homeowner's insurance. Why is your homeowner's insurance scary? Well, because if your home is more than 10 years old, or in fact, if it's increasingly older, 20, 30, 40 years old, more than likely your home insurance, your homeowner's insurance, will not pay you a dime. Because if you look at it closely, there are lists and lists of exclusions. Many of them, here's one little trick that they use, for example. They use today's building codes and zoning codes and building standards to examine claims with relative to your house if you put in some kind of a claim. And so they will say, for example, your house is built to substandard conditions or a substandard construction. Therefore, it is not covered under your homeowner's policy. And this then applies to most houses. And so if you look down the list of exclusions, actually, if you have a house that's 10 years old or more, chances are your homeowner's insurance will not pay you a dime. If there's an incident that requires that the bank be paid for something, And in many cases, if you have, for example, hail or lightning or wind or tornado, or if the house simply burns down, but there again, if your house is more than 10 years old, there could be exclusions in there that allow the insurance company to renege on paying you. So anyway, that's scary story number one. Scary story number two is starting tomorrow, November 1st, 2013, the United States is cutting food stamp benefits to over 45 million food recipients, many of whom that's their only form of income. That's pretty scary, folks. Pretty scary on Halloween 2013. Food stamp reception or use has grown by 70% since the year 2007. And that was only up to 2012. It has grown again. I would suspect that by now in 2013, we are a full 100% increase in food stamp recipients over the 2007 mark. That's scary, but starting tomorrow, the really scary part is that the U.S. government is cutting benefits to those 45 million food stamp recipients. Pretty scary Halloween 2013. And scary story number three. The U.S. Navy has plans to blow apart a Pacific island, which is an animal sanctuary. It's in the Marianas Islands. And I want you to refer you to this article. It's the webpage is globalresearch.ca, not com, .ca. So it's globalresearch.ca. The author of the article is Timothy Bancroft Hinchley, with an H. I believe that's how you pronounce it. But at any rate, yeah, scary story number three. The U.S. Navy about to blow up using for naval target practice a animal sanctuary, Paradise Island, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Okay, just a quick update on weather. Essentially, there is really no severe weather at this time. In fact, tonight, October 31st, 2013, marks the end of this year's hurricane season. And essentially, there wasn't one. And that's something I predicted from the very beginning. I predicted that the sun's energy, unless there was something amazing that would happen. In fact, there was during the epoch of the comet Isan interacting with the planet Mars. We had the typhoons in the Pacific. We had the flooding in the Pacific. We had the tremendous storms that rolled through the United States. But other than that, there was no severe hurricane season at all. And, of course, the National Hurricane Prediction Center predicted an above-average year. So those guys and ladies have egg all over their faces. And it makes you wonder why they're going to get any more funding. If somebody is completely wrong, by the way, they also are... Our groups, the global warming climate change groups, are predicted that every year there should be an increased number of hurricanes due to global warming. Well, obviously, that ain't happening. And so the standard science, once again, although they try their hardest to defend it, it simply doesn't work. The weather on Earth is not caused by sunlight. If we depended only on sunlight, Earth would have very bland, almost non-existent weather. 99.9% of all weather, including clouds, come from the electrical conditions in the solar system. So, but basically, at the beginning of the hurricane season back in June, I said, hey, it ain't happening. Not going to happen. There's no energy. There's no solar energy. being produced in this solar cycle is the weakest solar cycle in a couple hundred years. So don't expect much in terms of hurricanes, because the energy that produces the hurricane simply is not there. So once again, I was right, and all of the money, the billions, and the National Weather Service, weather.com, spaceweather.com, and all the boys and girls there, and all the king's horses and men, couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. That's the story of weather for 2013. Now, what's interesting is, let's fast forward to January of 2014, around the 13th to the 14th. And this is something that has is written all over the place in terms of my theoretical work with weather. That is a time in which we have Jupiter, comet Ison, up and above us, although it's not in the ecliptic plane, it's still up and behind us, and we've seen this situation, especially with comet Lee back in 1999, a very effective location for a comet. Plus, we have a new moon passing and the planet Venus all lined up linearly, electrically. And making predictions is difficult, but when the obvious ones come and smack you in the face, you have to say something. So let's see what takes place then. But I would expect some severe blizzards, because we're in the middle of winter, hurricane blizzard type situations, the same type of blizzard situations that occurred in 1991. Remember the Halloween blizzard of 1991? And then the Atlantic could erupt. It's difficult to say. Predictions are very difficult to say. Remember, we have a very weak sun. So that's another contributing factor on the negative side of the balance. So, the sun does seem to be responding well to comet Ison. And also, I'll be talking in a minute here about the November 13th and 14th electrical alignment of comet Ison with the planet Mercury, in which it's, once again, very difficult to predict. But comet Ison could interact with the planet Mercury, and we could see Mercury go comet. And it's a term that I developed. And by the way, a little side note, it's humorous. Obviously, I'm having causing a great amount of consternation amongst the, let's call them the disinformation crew, whose job it is to keep you in line and keep misinformation flowing to the public. Obviously, I'm creating quite a stir because people are listening to me. My predictions are correct. I said that comet Ison would affect Mars, and in fact, Mars went comet. And but here's the comical part. It seems like, obviously, I'm being shadowed. And anything I say or do then gets popped into YouTube videos and made into crazy stuff. So there's a bunch of YouTube videos saying that since Mars went comet, that proves that comet Ison is Nibiru, planet X. Well, of course that isn't true. That's gibberish. Anything. And then the people talk to their alien friends in these videos, and but you know, that's to be expected. That is the level of effort being put into trying to neutralize my message out there. Obviously, comet Ison is not Nibiru. It doesn't have a family of mini solar system associated with it. It's simply an energetic little comet. And but anyway, the prediction is that we should see some significant activity, not just due to the comet, but because of the overall solar system electrical path all the way from Jupiter, comet Ison, Earth, new moon, and Venus, a cross solar system electrical path. And when that baby hooks up, expect a little bit of activity. In fact, NASA has been so worried about my prediction that they've actually made up all kinds of garbage trying to say that there is a cone of debris that will come the size of ships and pieces of everything from basketball up to the size of large objects that will come raining in on Earth. Well, no, that's all baloney. And that's just the NASA side of the and the other just disinformation. Who knows where this comes from? So who makes it up? Who puts it out there? Why does it get on YouTube and on other press releases? Well, it's just insane, the amount of insanity out there. So at any rate, that is January 14th. That time frame, we should look for some serious weather activity on Earth. But and let me just review now the let me just finish the weather report here. Basically, there is no serious weather going on. Comet Ison is not affecting Earth at this time. There's a little bit of X-class flaring that happened in the last week, coming from the sun, and nothing serious, nothing to write home about. But I want you to all start getting ready for this November 13th and 14th date. Here's the situation. I've explained it before. Get yourself some good binoculars, astronomical binoculars. You should have these anyway. I've recommended this on my show before, and you should have these anyway. But go to a reputable astronomical house, or there's some good stores around the country in various places. If you're lucky to have one near you, support them. If not, go on the internet and find an astronomical supply house and purchase yourself some binoculars. Some people might want to get some bigger ones, but make sure you get a really doubly heavy-duty tripod, because that's absolutely essential. Get a tripod that's overkill in terms of the binoculars you're getting, because you need a good, stable base. You can't hand-hold binoculars and look at stars. Just doesn't work. But the minimum I would say is a 7 power with maybe a 40 centimeter lens. Those are the big lenses at the far lens of the binoculars. And also make sure that the lenses on the near side where your eyes go are big and round, maybe the size, not quite the size of a penny, but maybe half the size of a penny or larger. Because if they're too small, you're going to have eye fatigue, and it's just going to be very difficult to view. The thing about astronomical binoculars is they are coated. The lenses and the prisms are coated with a coating after the lenses are ground, and it gives them a perfectly smooth surface. And also there's some coloration sometimes that is put into that to allow a nice clear view of the sky, and learn how to focus them so you can put them in focus. But at any rate, the pair of binoculars I use have 100 centimeters optical lenses at the far end and 25 power. Beautiful, beautiful for viewing comets. Very bright. And that's what I use to observe Mars going comet. And by the way, I've observed Mars many times since then, and with the same equipment, obviously Mars went comet when Comet Ison passed. Something that, nobody in standard science wants to talk about that one. It just mums the word. But let me just say this. When I made that prediction that Comet Ison would interact with Mars, and that the issue about I created the term Mars going comet, that it could even do that, nobody in their wildest dreams would ever have imagined such a thing. There was no such term. that's a term I had to create because nobody had ever imagined such a thing, that a comet passing by a planet that close could cause the planet itself to turn into a comet. And so it's part of my work. It's a very direct result of my work. And lo and behold, it happened. It was observed by many, many people around the world. I got the feedback myself, and I observed it myself. So it's almost daily my work is being confirmed. And what's great, though, what's absolutely stunningly great, amazing, is that you people can see this for yourself. The detractors, the people that try and slam me on the internet, they just work their little tails off, their little government shill tails. But, you know, when the public can go out and see it themselves and witness it themselves, well, doggone, that's hard to beat. And that's what science is all about, is making predictions and having them verified. And there ain't nothing in standard science that would tell you that Mars should turn into a comet, develop a nice halo when a comet passes by, believe me, 7 million miles away. So at any rate, so back to Comet Ison passing behind, it's coming up behind the planet Mercury. Mercury is moving around in its orbit. And so start looking for Mercury around the 10th of November. Put that on your calendar, get up early in the morning, and a couple hours before sunrise. There won't be any moon to interfere. It'll be a beautiful, clear sky. Look into the east and identify the planet Mercury and start identifying it, because when you see Comet Ison, it will be on a line between where the sun is coming up. In fact, in your observations, wait out there like the 10th of November till the sun comes up and mark that position on the horizon where you are observing. And then go back to that same spot. Okay, now you know where the sun's coming up, and then you can draw a line kind of downwards. That's where the sun is going to be when you're observing Mercury in the early morning sky before the sun comes up. And on a direct line from where the sun is below the horizon to Mercury up above is where you will find Comet Ison, about equal distance that Mercury will be from the sun. Look upwards about that distance, and you will be able to see Comet Ison. We have a perfect broadside view of Comet Ison at that point, which means that if we see sunward spike activity on Comet Ison, then it is true sunward spike activity. One of the standard ploys of standard astronomy is to negate the visibility of sunward spikes. They say, oh, that's just an optical illusion. It's one of those type 2 tails, the thin type 2 tail that really points away from the sun, but because of the viewing angle, it only appears to be sunwards. Well, I developed a viewing session, many viewing sessions throughout the past 10 years, in which I have conclusively shown to the people that the spikes are sunward, because when you're looking broadside at the comet, the tail is sticking out to the right or to the left. It'll be actually sticking up in the case of Comet Ison, which you will see coming up here in mid-November. But when you see the spike at a broadside, and you see the spike, there's no question that it is coming out and it is in the sunward direction. And the reason for that is because it cannot be an anti-sunward tail, because that would be to the other side of the comet, where you're seeing the actual physical tail of the comet. So, and we've observed this number of times. I had a comet viewing session, I think it was back in around 2004, in which a couple comets came in, and we had pristine broadside viewing conditions, and people all over the world witnessed this, proving once again conclusively that the sunward spike is truly sunward and not an optical illusion. Remember now, Comet Ison is not going to be very big at this point, but what I'm hoping is that during this time when Mercury swings around between the comet and the sun, the comet will brighten greatly. It'll grow and brighten. And watch for that faint effect on the planet Mercury. If the planet Mars went comet, then the propensity, the possibility, and comet Ison is hanging in there. It's a green comet. It developed a fan sunward spike over the past about a week and a half ago. And I just think it's comical that places like Universe Today and SpaceWeather.com that post these amateur photos, fuzzy, out of focus pictures, good grief, boys and girls. You know, with all of the professional equipment that we have with NASA and the Hubble Space Telescope, NASA has over 60 telescopes, some of them in outer space, in all different frequencies of the electromagnetic spectrum. Looking at Comet Ison, we do not, as the public, we do not see one single photo ever from all of that equipment. Boys and girls, grandpas and grandpas, mothers and fathers, this is outrageous that all of this amazing equipment is out there. 60 telescopes taking pictures of that comet and not a single photo comes to you, the public. What's wrong with that picture? And what SpaceWeather.com silently thinking they're doing you a big favor post is a bunch of out of focus fuzzy pictures of the comet that couldn't possibly show you any real detail. And that's to try and force this idea that comets are dirty snowballs, little fluffy things that melt when they get near the sun. No, I'm sorry, not true. Comets are very complex plasma interactions, very complicated. NASA, with all of their 60 instruments focused on that comet, you better believe they're seeing all of this, but they ain't talking. Lying piece of you-know-what, NASA. Okay, so just a quick mention here. Now, so I just want you to put that on your calendars, November 10th. Get up early in the morning. Start looking for the planet Mercury in the early morning sky. Once you identify that, see if you can look up and see the comet Ison up above it in the early morning sky, and then start observing the brightness. Hopefully you have a nice clear sky for those days. And on the 13th and 14th of November is when the action should start, and then also that's when we should start seeing some serious solar activity begin, and that could continue from then on. Okay, just a quick announcement here. There's the Rosetta mission. It's a European Space Agency mission. Was launched in 2004, I believe, or 2002. I can't remember. But already performed a number of space missions. But now in January, it's going to wake up. January 2014, they're going to wake it up. And they have a lander called Philae. Philae, that would be the Latin pronunciation. It's spelled as if Latin. And so, anyway, it's a lander that's going to go in and harpoon into the nucleus of a comet and then blow with a kind of a cannon, they say about a 30-foot hole, into the surface of the comet, and then they're going to back off and ride alongside this comet nucleus for a period of years. And so that's going to start in August of 2014, the rendezvous with the comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko. And I don't know if I pronounced that 100% correctly. My Russian is not that good anymore. So at any rate, I will keep you posted on that little event. But we have visited many comets, and nowhere has anybody ever seen ice or snow on the surface of a comet. And the there was some jetting going on, and that's due to the electron beam hitting the nucleus of Halley's Comet. And by the way, the Giotto spacecraft measured directly the electron beam as it flew in front of the nucleus of Halley's Comet, and its electron sensor went off scale, and it started to gyrate. The spacecraft lost control, and they finally gained back control after a period of time. The point is that the electron beam to the sunward side of the comet nucleus that's coming out from the sun in the electrical discharge can hit the nucleus and basically, let's put it this way. If you want to cut steel, one of the techniques, instead of using a cutter's torch, is to use an electron beam. You can actually cut right through steel or scar steel with an electron beam. So it's a very powerful way of heating a surface. And so this is what's happening to the comet nucleus. And so it's blasting material off the tier 2 dirty snowball. People think, oh, that's just the sun's rays affecting the nucleus and blasting material off the nucleus. And no, that's not the case. It's the electron beam. And what I'm saying is that the Giotto spacecraft directly measured that. It's something that standard science just doesn't want to talk about. They can still talk about this fluffy little snowball and pretend that that's the solar wind gently removing little jets of dust and gases and carbon dioxide and water, ice melting, and etc. But when you look at the nucleus, Halley's nucleus, it was the blackest object in the solar system. It was pure black, tar black. And so at any rate, the other comets that we visited, not a shred of ice or snow or water on the nucleus, so and not a shred of water coming off the nucleus to make the tail. So direct proof that the dirty snowball comet model simply doesn't work. It's not there. Ain't happening. So at any rate, the point is that the electron beam on the sunward side of the comet nucleus at times can become intense enough to where it lights up the material. It becomes luminescent in the sunward side of the comet nucleus, and you can actually see that spike due to the electron beam. And that's an essential part of my plasma discharge comet model. All 100% confirmed and viewed many times. The first time it really struck modern astronomy was when Comet Errand Rowland rolled through the solar system in 1957, possibly before some of your time. But it was something that astronomers could not accommodate because at the time they thought, well, it's cold, it's the cold, electrically neutral atmosphere of outer space, a vacuum of outer space, and there couldn't be such a thing, so they tried to rationalize it, and they've been rationalizing the sunward spikes ever since. But like I said, in the case of Comet Ison coming up in November, we will have a perfect broadside view. So I hope that many of you get to see some sunward spike activity, and we could potentially see electrical connection to the planet Mercury. This would be something that we did not see any true electrical connection between Ison and the planet Mars. You did see the planet Mars go comet, but it would be nice to see the planet Mercury really develop a comet tail. And so, like I say, it's hard to predict. It would be something, a real first in the history of astronomy. But for the public to go out and look up and see this would be absolutely beyond phenomenal. Okay. I have one more topic I want to talk about this week, and as with almost all weeks, I end up talking with listeners for one reason or another. And this week, a woman called in from the Pacific Northwest, and she said, that she had purchased one of my pre-filters. And she didn't really know how much water you could put through the pre-filter, and the assumption was that it was due to radiation, the radiation from Fukushima. We also had a good discussion, and she was talking about the heavy level of radiation that they are announcing in that area. And she said there was an organic farm that had produce and stopped selling the produce because they said in good conscience they could not sell their produce to the public because it was so irradiated from the Fukushima radiation. But anyway, that's not the point of my discussion. I said it would be a good idea to tell people on the air how to use the pre-filter. And, of course, if you haven't seen this, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. Many of you have already purchased this for your gravity water filter. But basically, you put layers of powder in a kind of like a cone, and this sits on top of your regular water filter to pre-filter the water for chemicals, radiation, or oil. And so in the case of radiation, radiation loves to stick to dust particles and dirt. So it's not like you're filtering the radiation, you're filtering the dust that it's attached to. And so basically, if you're using the pre-filter, that by the way is only available on my webpage, the pre-filter, use common sense that when it no longer filters and it's too plugged up to filter, then you throw the powder out and put in new powder. By the way, you have to be careful not to allow the water to find a path through the powder, and therefore it's not being filtered at all. Filtration is a very difficult thing to describe many times to the public. The public thinks, oh, it's going to take 100% of whatever out, and that's not the case. The case with the pre-filter is you're trying to get as much of the gunk, the chemicals, the radiation attached to dust or oil or other pollutants, you're trying to get as much of it out of the water before you put it into your nice, clean gravity water filter. So just a comment, how much water can you filter in with one pouring of one amount of dust or powder that comes with the filter? How much water can you filter? Well, the answer is it depends. If you have very polluted water, then you have to change it when you see that it's not working anymore. It's very much a visual thing. But the pre-filter is something that I feel that everybody that has a gravity water filter, no matter what the make or model or what size, the pre-filter is something you should have. And it comes with accessory sets so that you will always have sufficient powder of the various types that come with the pre-filter. Anyway, basically the pre-filter is to remove the sludge, the industrial waste, the radiation, the oil, the pollutants, and try and get the majority of it out before you put the water into your nice, clean gravity water filter to do the final filtering. And so how are you going to, if you pour sludgy, polluted water into your nice, clean water filter, how are you going to clean it because you're not going to have clean water? It's going to plug up relatively quickly. And so, yes, you can clean, like my name brand water filters, yes, you can clean them, but my advice is to use the pre-filter first, especially if you're using river or pond water, or sometimes there are a lot of people who use it daily because their well water is so full of minerals, they actually pre-filter the water before they put it into their final water filter. The James McCanney name brand water filter, and they pre-filter it first to get the majority of the minerals that are in the water, the sulfur or other minerals that might be in the water, before they put it into their nice clean gravity water filter to do the final filtration. Okay, enough of that. So back to the concept of rogue waves. And what I love about this show is I give you current information, I give you an update on space conditions that affect you daily, and then I have time to sit back and relax and talk about scientific issues. I mentioned rogue waves at the beginning of the show, these great waves that come out of the middle of nowhere on the ocean, and we actually see these in real life in many circumstances. And so when I come out with my new release, the thing that it will include naturally in this organization that I have accomplished, and like I said before, what I've actually done here is organized something that heretofore had not really had any organization at all. And I've advanced the organization on this to a point where it's really something that the public has to see. And that's what I do. I work on many projects in the background. I do these on my own time, my own funding if there's costs involved. A lot of it is mental work, as is the case with this current project. But then every now and then it becomes so overwhelmingly obvious that this is an organized piece of information that should be released to the public, that I put it in a form and then release it to the public. And so let's just take a look at my books. The Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes book was the first book. It was a milestone. Nobody had ever put that amount of information together in one spot. And then as you continue through the series of books, say, for example, you get up to the Diamond Principle, the sixth book in the series. It really is a collection of material that describes what's going on in the world today. You have Tier 2 and Tier 3 mouthpieces trying to tell you what science is. They don't prove it. There's no experimentation. They just simply tell you what standard opinion is and expect you to say, oh, well, because standard science says it, it must be true. And that's what they're hoping to pawn off on you. I get a real kick out of these pages that criticize James McKinney. They repeat standard science and they go, therefore, James McKinney is wrong. And it's like, they don't present any science. They don't talk about any of the vast amount of detail like sunward spikes on comets, or they don't talk about the plasma effects or the fact that Mars went comet. they can't mention it because they have no explanation for that. So they just repeat standard science and say, oh, therefore McKinney is disproven. And so I just get a kick out of that. And the thing, though, that I got to tell you is that I have a really well-educated audience, and I see that time and time again. I see comments that they put on various places, very intelligent, well-versed audience. And there are people that were looking for answers, and I hear this all the time. People tell me, thank you for your work. You've really opened my eyes up and gave me the direction that I was looking for, because you know you weren't getting it in the universities. You weren't getting it in the standard information that's coming out of the press and the schmooze news and the hallowed halls of science. The information you get on my radio show and webpage are unique. And so all of the people that badmouth me and give me grief on the internet, all I can do is say, keep it up, because eventually all those people that read that end up on my webpage. Then they can see what I'm really saying. They can learn about who I really am. And so just keep up the good work. Keep up that bad advertising. Keep slamming me. Keep doing whatever it takes to try and muddy up my name, because you know what? All those people are going to end up on my webpage. Thank you very much. So at any rate, let's go back to rogue waves. Now, let's talk about wave action. Let's go to the bathtub. Let's go to something very simple. And let's take a tennis ball and put it in the middle of the bathtub with your fingers, like your three fingers are holding this tennis ball. The bathtub is perfectly calm, and you start pushing the tennis ball down, and then pulling it up, and pushing it down, and pulling it up, and pushing it down, and pulling it up. And you're making waves. Now, what's going to happen is these waves go to the side of the tub, they reflect off the side of the tub, and they come back together. Now, if you keep doing this, eventually you're going to create some rogue waves. And what happens is, let's take a certain wave pattern. You start out moving your tennis ball. It moves, the waves go out, it hit the side of the tub, those waves start moving back in towards the center of the tub again, and you keep doing this. Okay, now you have many, many wave patterns flowing out from the tennis ball, coming back in, etc. Now just watch the tub, and every now and then you're going to see a wave that kind of jumps up at you out of the tub. And that's where all of the various wave patterns add together and come up. And I want to recount a story. One time I was canoeing with some friends on a lake, and we came around an island. It was a tough windstorm. And so paddling around, all of a sudden the waves were coming around one side of the island, and then they were coming around the other side of the island. And where those waves met, it was a chop. It was like the waves were just coming up and down. It wasn't like they were flowing in a normal wave pattern. The waves were just coming up and down, and sometimes you'd have like a four-foot wave, just like a water shooting up in one spot. These are the rogue waves. And so what happens is out in the ocean, you have crossing wave patterns, sometimes two or three. And just coincidence, one set of waves crosses and meets with another one, and then a third, possibly even a fourth wave pattern, and you just happen to be the unlucky boater that happens to be there at that time. When that wave forms and whoosh, you get a 40-foot wave out of nowhere. That's a rogue wave. The reality is that systems in real life act the same. And so in my new organization that I'll be presenting here shortly, one of the things that happens is the rogue wave phenomenon. It's very interesting to see, and so that's another aspect that I want to prepare you for this new release. Remember to go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, because I don't get money from the government. I don't want it, never did. And so I'm very happy. And so your purchases at my webpage are the only thing that, the only income that I have to work with. And so I really appreciate everybody out there, the greatest fans in the world. So, and remember, we have a little thing called Christmas coming up. You can buy for other people. But just with the satisfaction, you're getting great products and you're helping out a great commercial-free radio show that you listen to every week. Thank you very much, and happy Halloween 2013. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.